So, and to some extent, I think it's about framing and picking your battles. But I guess the other thing I would say is if there's a battle that you don't think that you can make progress on and win in the short term, then pick a different one, you know, and that will follow. I really do think sort of the deeper issue gets down to public funding for public education and fighting for that, because a lot of other things flow from that. All right, we only have time for one more question here.
You mentioned that you advocate a push for an elimination of corporate funding from universities. Considering the proportion of overall funding that currently comes from the corporate sector, it seems like an immediate cessation of this would lead to a crumbling of universities as we know them. So it would have to be obviously supplemented with the what you call the broader democracy movement. But would you support this as an immediate political goal, or just as kind of a guiding principle?
Sure, I would support it as an immediate political goal. And it's important to recognize that, first of all, that while corporate funding is a problem in public education, it's not actually that large a percentage of the overall budget at any particular school. And it's generally located in a couple departments. So yeah, it would cause, let me put it this way, African American studies would have no problems, right? If you were to cut, if you were just to institute that firewall. Now, genetics, the new genetics buildings they're building all over the country, well, they might have some financial crunches because they've been planning on being reliant on corporate funding. The other thing that goes on with it is that most of the money that goes into research at public universities comes from either private sources like you, students, or it comes from the public, in some cases federal grants and also sort of the infrastructure of the university itself that's publicly funded. And it's only a small proportion, I believe roughly 20% on average, that comes from private corporations. Now, the reason why it's a problem is that 20% will leverage the other 80%, right? It drives the research agenda. So actually, I'd say eliminating tuition would cause a major problem in terms of the financing of public universities. As time goes on, the public institutions become more and more dependent on student dollars to fund them. But I'd say that actually instituting that firewall should be an immediate demand right now, in the here and now. And that at the same time, again, I think fighting for full public funding of public education is really key. And that's really got to be a central demand, because it not only does it have impacts on every sort of issue that we've talked about, but it also unites all the constituencies. So thanks for having me.
That was Ben Mansky on Higher Education and the Democracy Movement, the Public University in an Age of Corporatization. He spoke at the Democracy and Education Conference at the Storrs campus of the University of Connecticut on April 2, 2006. The website that he named during his talk was www.tni.org. You will need those W's. This will bring you to the website of the Transnational Institute. There you can find the Public Services Yearbook. And the website he mentioned during the questions was tentstate.org. That's tent with a T. And thanks for listening.
And thanks to George King for that report and recording. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. And now we continue with our history of corporate interests in education as we conclude Chapter 9 of John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. Going back to the early 20th century fight over schooling and democracy. The Gary tale is a model of how managed school machinery can be geared up in secret without public debate to deliver a product parents don't want. Part one of the Gary story is the lesson we learned from the impromptu opinion poll of Gary schooling taken by housewives and immigrant children, a poll whose results translated into riots. Having only their native wit and past experience to guide them, these immigrant parents concluded that Gary schools were caste schools, not what they expected from America. They turned to the only weapon at their disposal, disruption, and it worked. They shrewdly recognized that boys in elite schools wouldn't tolerate the dumbing down their own were being asked to accept. They knew this would close doors of opportunity, not open them. Some individual comments from parents and principals about Gary are worth preserving. Quote, too much play and time wasting. They spend all day listening to the phonograph and dancing. They change class every 40 minutes. My daughter has to wear her coat constantly to keep it from being stolen. The cult of the easy. A step backwards in human development. Focusing on the group instead of the individual. One principal predicted if the plan were kept, retardation would multiply as a result of minimal contact between teachers and students. And so it has. Part two of the Gary story is the official Rockefeller report condemning Gary, circulated at Rockefeller headquarters in 1916, but not issued until 1918. Why this report was suppressed for 2 years, we can only guess. You'll recall Mayor Hyland's charge that the Rockefeller Foundation moved heaven and earth to force its Gary plan on an unwitting and unwilling citizenry, using money, position, and influence to such an extent that a New York State Senate resolution of 1916 accused the foundation of moving to gain complete control of the New York City Board of Education. Keep in mind that Rockefeller people were active in 1915, 1960, and 1917, lobbying to impose a Gary destiny on the public schools of New York City, even after its own House analyst pointed to the intellectual damage these places caused. The 1916 analytical report leapfrogged New York City to examine the original schools as they functioned back in Gary, Indiana. Written by Abraham Flexner, it stated flatly that Gary schools were a total failure, offering insubstantial programs and a general atmosphere which habituated students to inferior performance, close quote. Flexner's analysis was a massive repudiation of John Dewey's shallow Schools of Tomorrow hype for Gary. Now we come to the mystery. After this bad idea crashed in New York City in 1917, the critical Rockefeller report held in-house since 1916 was issued in 1918. To embarrass critics who claimed the whole mess was the idea of the Rockefeller project officers. So we know in retrospect that the Rockefeller Foundation was aware of serious shortcomings before it used its political muscle to impose Gary on New York. Had the Flexner Report been offered in a timely fashion before the riots, it would have spelled doom for the Gary plan. Why it wasn't has never been explained. The third and final part of the Gary story comes straight out of Weird Tales. In all existing accounts of the Gary drama, none mentions the end of Superintendent Wirt's career after his New York defeat. Only Diane Ravitch in The Great School Wars even bothers to track Wirt back home to Gary, where he resumed the superintendency and became, as she tells us, a very conservative schoolman in his later years. Ah, what Ravitch missed. The full facts are engrossing. 17 years after Wirt left New York City, a government publication printed the next significant chapter of the Wirt story. Its title, Hearings, House Select Committee to Investigate Certain Statements of Dr. William Wirt, 73rd Congress, 2nd Session, April 10th and 17th, 1934. It seems that Dr. Wirt, while in Washington to attend a school administrators' meeting in 1933, had been invited to an elite private dinner party at the home of a high Roosevelt administration official. The dinner was attended by well-placed members of the new government, including A.A. Burrell, a famous inner circle brain truster. There, word heard that the Depression was being artificially prolonged by credit rigging until little people and businessmen were shaken enough to agree to a plan where government must dominate business and commerce in the future. All this he testified to before Congress. The transformation was to make government the source of long-term capital loans. Control of business would follow. Wirt testified he was told Roosevelt was only a puppet, that the hosts had made propaganda a science, that they could make newspapers and magazines beg for mercy by taking away much of their advertising, that provided they were subservient, leaders of business and labor would be silenced by offers of government contracts for materials and services, that college and schools would be kept in line by promises of federal aid until such time as they were under safe control, and that farmers would be managed by letting key operators, quote, get their hands in the public trough, close quote. In the yellow journalism outburst following Wirt's disclosure, Burrell admitted everything, but he said they were just pulling Wirt's leg. Pulling the leg of the one-time nationally acclaimed savior of public education. Time magazine, the New York Times, and other major media ridiculed Wirt, effectively silencing him. Of Wirt's earlier New York foray into the engineering of young people, New York City Mayor Hyland was quoted vividly in the New York Times of March 27, 1922. "The real menace to our republic is this invisible government, which, like a giant octopus, sprawls its slimy length over city, state, and nation. It has seized in its tentacles our executive officers, our legislative bodies, our schools, our courts, our newspapers, and every agency created for the public protection." To depart from mere generalizations, let me say that at the head of this octopus are the Rockefeller Standard Oil interests. Close quote. Like many of the rest of you, I was conditioned early in adult life to avoid conspiracy talk and conspiracy talkers by the universal scorn heaped upon the introduction of such arguments into the discourse. All, quote, responsible journalistic media and virtually all of the professoriate allowed public access through those media respond reflexively and negatively, it seems, to any hint of a dark underside to our national life. With that in mind, what are we to make of Mayor Hyland's outburst, or for that matter, the statements of three senators quoted later on this page? Don't expect me to answer that question for you, but do take a deep breath and make the effort to read Thomas Hobbes' Leviathan, written back in the 17th century, but easily located in every library of any size in the United States, for some enlightenment in your ruminations. During the crucial years of the school changeover from academic institution to behavioral modification instrument, the radical nature of the metamorphosis caught the attention of a few national politicians who spoke out, but could never muster enough strength for effective opposition. In the Congressional Record of January 26, 1917, for instance, Senator Chamberlain of Oregon entered these words, quote, "They are moving with military precision all along the line to get control of the education of the children of the land," close quote. And Senator Poindexter of Washington followed, saying, quote, "The cult of Rockefeller, the cult of Carnegie, as much to be guarded against in the educational system of this country as a particular religious sect." Close quote. And in the same issue, Senator Kenyon of Iowa related, quote, "There are certain colleges that have sought endowments, and the agent of the Rockefeller Foundation or the General Education Board had gone out and examined the curriculum of these colleges and compelled certain changes. It seems to me one of the most dangerous things that can go on in a republic is to have an institution of this power apparently trying to shape and mold the thought of the young people in the country. Close quote. Senator Works of California added, quote, "These people are attempting to get control of the whole educational work of the country." Close quote. If it interests you, take a look. It's all in the Congressional Record of January 26, 1917. And I'm reading from The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. Three major obstacles stood in the way of the great goal of using American schools to realize a scientifically programmed society. The first was the fact that American schooling was locally controlled. In 1930, when the massive socializing scheme was swinging into high gear, helped substantially by an attention-absorbing depression, this nation still had 144,102 local school boards. At least 1.1 million elected citizens of local stature made decisions for this country's schools out of their wisdom and experience. Out of the 70 million adults between the ages of 30 and 65, one in every 63 was on a school board. 30 years earlier, the figure had been 1 in 20. Contrast either ratio with today's figure of 1 in 5,000. The first task of scientifically managed schooling was to transfer management from a citizen yeomanry to a professional elite under the camouflage of consolidation for economy's sake. By 1932, the number of school districts was down to 127,300. By 1937 to 119,018, and it had dropped by 1950 to 83,719, to almost half that in 1960, 40,520, and half again by 1970 to 18,000. By 1990 to 15,361. Citizen oversight was slowly squeezed out of the school institution. Replaced by homogeneous managerial oversight, managers screened and trained, watched, loyalty checked by Columbia, Stanford, Chicago, the Cleveland Conference, and similar organizations with private agendas for public schooling. The second obstacle to an ideological takeover of schools was the historic influence of teachers as role models. Old-fashioned teachers had a disturbing proclivity to stress development of intellect through difficult reading, heavy writing assignments, and intense discussion. The problem of proud and independent teachers was harder to solve than the reading problem. As late as 1930, there were still 149,400 one-room, one-teacher schools in America, places not only cheap to operate, but successful at developing tough-minded, independent thinkers. Most of the rest of our schools were small and administrator-free, too. The idea of principals who did not teach came very late in the school game in most places. The fantastic notion of a parasitic army of assistant principals, coordinators, and all the rest of the various familiar specialists of institutional schooling didn't exist at all until 1905, except in the speculations of teacher college dreamers. Two solutions were proposed around 1903 to suppress teacher influence and make instruction teacher-proof. The first was to grow a heretofore unknown administrative hierarchy of non-teaching principals, assistant principals, subject coordinators, and the rest, to drop the teacher's status rank. And if degrading teacher status proved inadequate, another weapon, the standardized test, was soon to be available. By displacing the judgmental function from a visible teacher to a remote bastion of educational scientists somewhere, no mere classroom person could stray very far from approved texts without failing test scores among his or her students, signaling the presence of such a deviant. Both these initiatives were underway as World War I ended. The third obstacle of effective centralization of management was the intimate neighborhood context of most American schools, one where school procedures could never escape organic oversight by parents and other local interests. Not a good venue from which to orchestrate the undermining of traditional society. James Bryant Conant, one of the inventors of the poison gas Lewis Day, and by then chairman of a key Carnegie commission, reported in an ongoing national news story after the Sputnik moment that it was the small size of our schools causing the problem. Only large schools, said Conant, could have faculty and facilities large enough to cover the math and science we presumably lacked and Russia presumably had. The bigger, the better. In one bold stroke, the American factory school of Lancaster days was reborn. Here, a de-intellectualized Prussian-style curriculum could reign undetected. From 1960 to 1990, while student population was increasing 61%, the number of school administrators grew 342%. In constant dollars, costs shot up 331%, and teachers, who had fallen from 95% of all school personnel in 1915 to 70% in 1950, now fell still further, down and down, until recently they comprised less than 50% of the jobs in the school game. School had become an employment project, the largest hiring hall in the world, bigger than agriculture, bigger than armies. One other significant set of numbers parallels the absolute growth in the power and expense of government schooling, but inversely. In 1960, when these gigantic child welfare agencies called schools were just setting out on their enhanced missions, 85% of African American children in New York were from intact two-parent households. In 1990 in New York City, with the school budget drawing $9,300 a kid for its social welfare definition of education, that number dropped below 30%. School and the social work bureaucracies had done their work well. And he doesn't mention, but I will, the prison industrial complex. Fashioning what looked to be a permanent underclass, once stripped of its possibility of escape, turned against itself. Scientific management had proven its value, although what that was obviously depended on one's perspective. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, that the conclusion of Chapter 9, The Cult of Scientific Management. John Taylor Gatto is a former award-winning New York teacher who is now one of the foremost spokespeople for homeschooling and self-directed education, which he calls unschooling. For more on his work, visit johntaylorgatto.com. And we'll conclude the program with a discussion of the rise of what has come to be a sister institution to schools, that is, prisons. Emily Aspinwall of Stark Raven Radio in Vancouver gets an international perspective on the corporate connection.
When there is a problem in our communities, we are often told that the solution lies in forming new laws that will ban the unwanted behavior. That way, the people seen as creating the problem can be removed, prosecuted, and punished. This criminalization approach is being used more and more in communities all over the world. This is happening at the same time as neoliberal economic policies are expanding across the globe. Vivian Stern has been investigating these connections between neoliberalism and the creation of crime. She's the author of Creating Criminals, Prisons and People in a Market Society. She's a senior research fellow at the School of Law at King's College in London and the honorary president of the organization Penal Reform International. And she joins me on the phone today from England. Well, welcome to the show, Vivian. It's great to have you here, and thanks for speaking with me.
It's a real pleasure, Emily. I'm delighted to be on.
So when I first saw your book, what intrigued me most was the emphasis on the connection between the free market and this concept of creating criminals. Why did you decide to focus on this connection in your book? The history, if we look back, how have these connections between increasing criminalization and the rise of neoliberal economies, how has it that developed over time?
Nobody's really yet done that study. It has, in a sense, for those of us who've been in this field for a long time, come along and hit us on the back of the head, in the sense that we were not expecting it, and it has moves quite quickly. If you think, for example, of private prisons, we which I have to say are still an terribly small part of the mass privatizations that have gone on around various parts of the world. Private prisons, not that long ago, say 1990, our politicians in England were saying, this is unthinkable. In 1996, members of what are now the Labour government were saying, private prisons are repugnant, morally repugnant. By 1997, the same people were issuing the contracts. So this has happened very quickly. It has not been much debated. And the involvement of private companies has, in a sense, been very backdoor. Involvement in surveillance, involvement in electronic monitoring of people, an enormous amount of involvement in the whole immigration process. And suddenly, you find that who are the people in the government seeing? They're not seeing the criminal justice organizations, the churches organizations that are concerned with this. They're actually seeing people from the companies who will say, we can do a lot of things for you cheaply, but we'll need economies of scale. And gradually you see penal policy reshaping itself away from the community level, away from perhaps the voluntary organizations, the non-profit organizations that were often involved with offenders, and into a completely different arena where what's offered is much more technological and is felt to be much cheaper per head. So it's not been very well documented, and it's happened quite suddenly and in many ways very quietly.
Yeah, I think that pressure of privatization and the direct private interests in the criminal justice system may be kind of an obvious pressure that people can see. But some of the other things that you mentioned, one I wanted to focus on was this idea of creating insecurity and the connections between those economic policies, insecurity, and the criminal justice system. Maybe you can expand a little bit more on that concept.
Documented, but you certainly see now in some of our countries, and I don't think this is happening everywhere, it's probably not happening, for instance, in Scandinavia, where the increase in incarceration is very small, but you do see that the agenda now is about risk, and it is about insecurity. And this is obviously very closely linked to the new ways in which people relate to their work and to whether or not they will have a job and whether or not they will have a pension and whether or not their financial future is secure. This has changed enormously over the last 20 years. As has also the provision of welfare levels and the security of welfare. Welfare is much more conditional in many countries on whether people will conform to certain requirements of the state. And altogether, the political discourse has moved towards managing risk and insecurity. And therefore, more and more parts of life have been identified as risks to our security, and governments are committing themselves to doing something about it. You see that, for instance, in England, in a movement against something called antisocial behaviour, which is behaviour that is defined as antisocial by the person who looks at it. There's no objective definition. If you feel harassed and threatened by some behaviour, it's antisocial, and the perpetrators of that behaviour will then be subject to a range of orders which can eventually turn them into criminal offences, and they can end up imprisoned. And this whole process of which we live and then turning them into crimes has been very much a feature of the discourse in countries that are wedded to a much more free market approach. And England certainly is one of them.
The other thing you mentioned was this idea of the commodification of justice. Can you tell us more about what you mean by that?
Yes, that's also quite complicated. Certainly we're seeing in this society, and I imagine it's happening elsewhere, a transformation of people from citizens to consumers. And then a new way of looking at our public services, which is not that they are provided by all of us through our taxes for all of us, and we share them, and we try and ensure those who need them most get them, but they are much more analogous to going shopping, and people should have choice, and they should look more like the sort of things you get when you go shopping, and you should fight to get the best for yourself. In the past, there was more an idea that they were shared, and we all paid for them, and we all were part of them. Now, when this is done to justice, it's hard to see what it is you're going to give people. You're going to try and give people safe streets and make sure their cars aren't broken into, their houses aren't broken into. But what has happened very, very noticeably in the last 10 or 15 years is to re-describe justice as something that you get when someone else has been punished for what they did to you. And that is now what the word justice means in a lot of the discourse in England, certainly in England. And I'm saying England very deliberately because Scotland is a devolved country which has a very different view of the world. But in England, there will be a lot of talk about they're entitled to justice. And this justice is not justice for all of us. Well, the just outcome might be that the person isn't punished. The just outcome might be that the person gets some health care. The just outcome might be that the person gets a lot of help from the welfare system. But when justice is reduced to an individual commodity, it is then described as a punishment inflicted on the perpetrator. And when that's happened, you've got your justice. So it's an individualization. It's seeing each person as a customer or as an individual economic unit, and you're entitled to something, and the state will give you this, and they will give you a certain amount of punishment. And it seeps into everybody's thinking, and people who have been victims of crime saying, I didn't get my justice, and I want my justice, and I felt I got justice because he got 10 years or 12 years. But of course, it's not an individual relationship. It is actually something, justice is for all of us, and can't really be broken down in that way. But that has become the driver of how punishment is allocated and the driver of the discourse in the media about how cases are dealt with, which has been led to a terrific escalation. You probably haven't been following the chaos that is the criminal justice system in England, where the government is trying to buy some boats to put more prisoners in, and finding an old hospital to convert, and keeping prisoners in police cells overnight, because they keep giving out this justice and they haven't got the places to put them when they've given it out.
So I'm curious about the whole way that we can get people to question the role of prisons in our society, and I see this as one way we can do that if we really try to look at the concept of what a crime is and who has the power to label people a criminal. Do you have any comments on questioning those concepts and then relating that to the role of prisons in our society?
It's very important, and I do try to do this, to explain that an act crime when someone decides thus. So I'll give you an example that really weighs heavily on me when I think that it happened in this country. A woman with a very severe depressive illness jumped from a very high bridge with her baby in order to kill herself and her baby because she felt the world was too terrible for a child to grow up in. Very miraculously, she and the baby survived, which is very unusual when people jump from that very high bridge. I don't know what in most countries would happen to such a poor woman and her baby. They both, she survived, and the baby survived. But in this country, she was then charged with attempted murder of her baby and sent to prison for 18 months. Now, in my view, that is a very, very clear example of the creation of crime, when in almost every country I can think of, that would have been a case of tragic mental illness. And that example is quite a clear one that people can see, that a crime has in a sense been created to fit a circumstance where for almost anyone who had a moral sense, that would not be appropriate. And you can see that in a number of the laws that are coming in this country, and it's also the case in the United States and less so in other European countries, that more and more acts that may cause harm, may result from illness, may just result from wanting to live in a different way, are being labeled as against the criminal law and then lead the person down the path of social exclusion and stigma. And it's a stigma that it's almost impossible to shake off. Once someone's been to prison, their whole life will be affected forever, regardless of how serious or not the offence was. And we see more and more, as the money for welfare and health is reduced, the casualties, the people that miss out, are being redefined. I don't think in this country 15 years ago a woman who jumped off a bridge with a depressive illness would ever have been seen as committing a criminal act. This is something very new and, in my view, deeply reprehensible. But that's what's happening. And there is some quite interesting work which is being put together showing countries which spend more on welfare spend less on their criminal justice and their repressive parts of their society. It is, in a sense, a choice. You see it very clearly in the United States, where they decided to have prisons rather than education, and where there were more black men incarcerated than went to university. And you see it in our society, where more money has been spent on the repression, prisons, and everything to do with the criminal law, where welfare spending has been held. And it's a transfer from social inclusion, accepting people as fellow citizens, to exclusion and stigmatization of those who don't fit in.
So I'm curious about how this taking a legal approach to dealing with community and social problems impacts the fabric of the community, the social interactions, sort of the psychology of community building. Do you have any comment on that?
Of course, is very damaging for cohesive communities, and we have quite a lot of evidence of that. When we say to our communities, if you think young people are antisocial, take photographs photographs of what they're doing, get in touch with the authorities, give them the evidence. They'll then have an order put on them saying they mustn't swear in the street, they mustn't walk across this housing area, they mustn't ever wear a hood over their head. And you say that to a 14-year-old boy, I think he's likely to keep those conditions for about 10 minutes or less, if at all, before they're broken. You then take another photograph of the child with the hood on, or record swearing in the street, picture the child walking through the street is not to walk, you report it to the authorities, and the child is then taken to court, and if the court is so minded, the child can be sent to prison for breaking the requirements of the order. So instead of people in the community feeling, we've got kids here, they've got nothing to do and they're hanging about and they're noisy and we need a youth club and we might even volunteer, they say, right, we can get rid of them. If they break the orders, they'll go to prison. That would be good. So you gradually divide your communities into those who have problems or who just happen to be young and they have nowhere to go, and those who are able to see a way of getting rid of them. It is extremely damaging and breaks up some traditions we've had, certainly in England, for many years of community involvement and trying to get the children to grow up within a very socialized framework. All that is being destroyed by this approach to people that are slightly problematic.
Another thing that struck me as I was reading your book was the amount of research and examples that you cite. You've gathered stories from communities from all over the world and were able to give quite a global picture of this whole process of criminalization and the connection with the economic policies. Can you just give us a brief overall global picture of how these things are looking?
There's a lot of work going on in this area. I think it's quite clear that, and it's not even argued now, that the economic globalization, which is a shorthand for the influence of the free market, has increased inequality enormously. There's no doubt. I think we can all agree on that. Some will say it's a price worth paying and others will say it's not. I think it's not. So we have seen in most countries a huge increase between the few rich and the many poor. We also have very good research showing that high levels of crime and violence in a country correlate closely with high levels of inequality. So one of the spin-offs of the inroads of the free market into the world economy is high levels of crime and violence in the poorer countries of the world. If you look at Brazil as an example, the inequality in Brazil, I think, is one of the most dramatic in the world. And it is well known that the levels of violence in Brazil are amongst the highest in the world. I think more people are killed in Brazil than are killed in a number of the civil wars going on around the world, because the levels of violence correlate very closely with the enormous inequalities they have. So that is one of the consequences of the neoliberal impact on the world, that crime and violence do increase in the poorer parts of the world. And the impact of that, of course, is felt mainly by the poor, because the rich build themselves a house with a big wall and a dog and a guard and go out in a car that's bulletproof, and the poor are caught up in life on the streets, which is violent and where life can be very short. So I think we've seen an impact in increasing crime, and then an increase in the inability of the justice systems to cope with it, an increase in terribly overcrowded prisons, very violent, very cruel prisons, and an increase in corruption, which rots a justice system at its root, which you see in many countries in the world. It's an aspect of globalization that's often talked about, but it is very serious for those who have to live with it and for those who have to work in the justice systems in those parts of the world.
One of the six chapters in your book focuses on specific examples, and that's the war on drugs and migration.
Yes.
And I'm just curious as to why you chose to focus on these two issues specifically in your book. Why did you think they warranted their own chapter?
Both of them really merit a book in themselves, but it's hard to talk about what's happening in the criminal justice systems of the world and ignore drugs. Because the fact that certain substances are illegal has an enormous and very detrimental effect on criminal justice systems. The United Nations treaties and obligations that countries have about drugs are very narrow and very constraining. And the United States government has a very clear view about what should be illegal, which has a disastrous effect on poor countries where possession of small amounts of these sort of substances are criminalized and the prisons are filled up with poor women, for instance, who carry small amounts of drugs for other people. And if there were a different approach to which substances were illegal, the prison populations of the world could be enormously reduced and the corruption in criminal justice systems could be reduced. Because having this worldwide view, which is imposed on everyone, whatever their cultures and whatever their traditions, about what should be illegal, puts an enormous amount of pressure on countries that have very scarce resources. So you can't really look at this question at all without taking into account the so-called war on so-called drugs. Migration is a more recent one, but if you look now at the prisons of Europe and the amount of detention in Europe, for example, and in Europe, I must say, our immigration policies are so far behind those in Canada that we suffer greatly, you will see that the criminalization of moving from one country to another has increased a great deal in the last few years. More and more countries are locking up more and more people for the crime of moving from A to B without the right bit of paper, which has become a crime in many countries. And a number of aspects of migration, like destroying your passport, becomes a crime. Arriving in a country and not saying which country you came from will become a crime. And more aspects of trying to get from a poor place to a rich place have become crimes. So that criminal justice systems are being subjected to this pressure as well of people from other countries, and often from much poorer countries or from countries in turmoil, trying to find a refuge and ending up the wrong side of the criminal justice system. So although there are probably a number of other matters one might have considered, it seemed to me that drugs and migration together were having quite a marked effect on what was happening to the swamping of criminal justice systems, which puts them in a position where they can't cope, and where the prison, which could, in an ideal world, be a place where people who have to be held are held and are treated very well, the prison just becomes a transit camp full of people who are being just counted, fed, and dealt with as best they can and given a place to sleep. And the criminal justice system it begins to collapse under those circumstances.
I think also it's probably important to note that a lot of people are migrating, moving, as you mentioned, from poor countries to rich countries because of these same neoliberal economic policies.
Indeed, because certainly the impoverishment of Africa through these policies has made people feel they take the risk of drowning on a little boat trying to get to the bottom of Europe or to the Canary Islands, that it's worth, they know when they set out that the chances of drowning are very high and they will still do it because they have so little to lose. And that is indeed one of the effects of the impoverishment of African countries through policies of policies imposed by the World Bank and the IMF in years gone by.
And you have, your book is full of stories. You must have spoken to a lot of people and collected a lot of different stories and research. And I'm wondering which stories brought you hope for a different approach to dealing with some of these issues.
Well, it is quite difficult to be optimistic. But on the other hand, I do tend towards optimism. And all over the world, you do find people who are not going to accept little more normal. And of course, there are people who are resisting the trend. I mean, for example, Finland, Denmark, Norway, and Sweden, in spite of these pressures, are managing to say, we will not have a huge number of people in prison. We will not go down that road. In Ireland, which is a small country, they brought in a completely new law to deal with juveniles in trouble, where the whole emphasis will be on either some form of restorative justice where the child and the community and the family can work it out together, or they have the power to require the health services to take over the case of the child and to give the appropriate care. And that new, whole new, completely new approach to dealing with juveniles in Ireland is coming into force in a couple of months' time. So all over the world you can pick up these examples where someone said, I'm not going to do this. This is not how we want it to be. This is not how we want our country to be. And in the circumstances in which we live, this is difficult to do, but it can be done. And I'm optimistic that we may have reached a point where people are beginning to see that we have to take a different path.
Vivian Stern is the author of Creating Criminals, Prisons and People in a Market Society.
The interviewer was Emily Aspinwall of Stark Raven Radio at CFRO Vancouver, cooperadio.org. And you can download this episode and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at our archive at www.unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, was performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.